July 26, 1974, Barnstable County, Massachusetts. The new decomposed body of a young woman is discovered at the Race Point Dunes outside of Provincetown. The woman has been murdered by a blunt force trauma to the head, which has nearly been severed from her body, but she carries no identification. In spite of an extensive investigation, police are unable to uncover the identity of the victim or her killer, so she simply becomes known as the Lady of the Dunes. Over the years, there have been a number of intriguing leads in the case, including a potential connection to an infamous mobster and an alleged sighting of the victim in one of the biggest Hollywood blockbusters of all time. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I am your host, Robin Warder, and today we are going to venture back into a gruesome but very interesting subject for true crime buffs, unidentified decedents. Today's case is another request by a poster from the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, who goes by the handle Unsolved88. Unsolved88 was the one who requested that I cover the Laureen Ron case several months back, and he is always sending me suggestions. And since I was in the mood to do another episode about an unidentified decedent, I decided to choose this case. So, thank you, Unsolved88. You might recall that back in May, I did an episode on the El Dorado Jane Doe, a young woman who was murdered in El Dorado, Arkansas in 1991. Even though she had several friends who knew her as Mercedes, it turned out that the victim had been living under several different false names for years, and to this day, no one knows her true identity. As a result, she is known as El Dorado Jane Doe. Sadly, there are thousands of more cases just like this, where a male or female victim is found deceased, and when their identity cannot be established, they become known as either John Doe or Jane Doe. They remain that way indefinitely until their true identity is uncovered, but unfortunately, sometimes that just never happens. As I mentioned on the El Dorado Jane Doe podcast, there is a website devoted to this subject called the Doe Network, which is an online database containing profiles for thousands of unidentified decedents. It's often referred to as Facebook for the dead. The situation is particularly tragic whenever a John Doe or Jane Doe is murdered. In the case of El Dorado Jane Doe, investigators knew right from the outset who her killer was and put him behind bars. But that's not the case with today's story, as the identity of both the victim and her killer are still a mystery. The victim in question is known as the Lady of the Dunes, and during the past 40 years there have been some unique twists and turns in the quest to get her identified. I have previously featured this case in an article I wrote for listverse.com, 10 Totally Mysterious Stories Involving Unidentified People, which was published in April of 2015. My best case scenario is that maybe this podcast will somehow play a role in helping the Lady of the Dunes get her identity back. But before we get started, I'd like to take a moment to provide a brief review of a book I recently read, which might be of interest to all you true crime followers. It was provided to me by a listener of this podcast, Kelsey McBride, who happens to be the president and CEO of Book Publicity Services, a public relations company which helps garner exposure for unknown authors and their books. Kelsey sent me a book titled The Blood on My Hands, written by Shannon O'Leary. That is not the author's real name, for reasons which will soon become clear. The Blood on My Hands is Shannon O'Leary's harrowing autobiography of her traumatic childhood in Australia during the 1960s and 70s. She was forced to grow up under a violent alcoholic father named Patrick, who physically abused his wife and kids at every opportunity and sexually abused Shannon. But the most shocking part is that Patrick also happened to be a serial killer, and on more than one occasion, Shannon was forced to witness her father murder some victims and dispose of their remains. However, Patrick never faced justice for his actions. One of the most disturbing elements of this story is the sheer indifference Shannon and her family face from others when they try to seek help. Even though they are the victims, they are often made to feel like they are the ones doing something wrong by daring to speak ill of the man of the house. The police even act like they are powerless to do anything about Patrick's abuse until he actually goes so far as to murder one of his family members. By the time Shannon got old enough to finally convince the police to look into these murders she witnessed her father commit, the victim's remains were nowhere to be found, so he was never officially connected with any crimes. By the end of the novel, I was left wondering just how many unsolved missing persons cases from Australia during the 1960s and 70s this man could be responsible for, but no one has ever been able to link them together. Like I said earlier, Shannon O'Leary is a pseudonym, so no real names are used throughout the course of this book. But the good news is that Shannon was able to break free from this cycle of abuse and grew up to become a very successful figure in the entertainment industry in Australia. The Blood on My Hands is very hard to read sometimes, as Shannon pulls no punches at describing the horror of the abuse she suffered. But it's still a very powerful, well-written story, and effectively conveys the sheer helplessness of being trapped in an abusive relationship. This is from a time period where women were still expected to do everything their husband told them to do, even if he was a complete monster. And you can see how badly Shannon's mother is treated for attempting to break away from this. But Shannon, her mother, and her siblings deserve all the credit in the world for being able to escape this situation. As harrowing as this story may be, it's pretty inspiring to know that Shannon was able to recover and go on to live a very successful life. But it's still chilling to know that there are still some unknown murder victims out there who never got justice, and I hope that the crimes described in the story can be solved someday. So if you've got the stomach for it, I highly recommend reading The Blood on My Hands by Shannon O'Leary, which is available at Amazon.com. And a special thank you to Kelsey McBride, who sent me The Blood on My Hands and has helped garner a lot of publicity for this book. If there are any aspiring authors out there seeking some extra publicity for their own books, check out the website for Kelsey's company at bookpublicityservices.com. That's bookpublicityservices.com. Now, let's just take a brief moment to get some business out of the way. As you might already know, The Trail Went Cold has recently gone from being a bi-weekly podcast to a weekly podcast. We are now alternating between our regular full-length episodes like this one and 10 to 15 minute mini-sodes about smaller scale cold cases which don't have as much material to explore. So we have entered the cycle of delivering either a regular episode or a mini-sode every Wednesday. We're currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it. If you give us a rating or a review at any of these sites, you're opening the door for us to get more exposure and garner us some potential new listeners. The Trail Went Cold now has its own PayPal account and a new donate button on the website for anyone who's feeling generous. We recently received a donation from a listener named Emily, so thank you very much for that, Emily. If there's anyone else out there who feels like making a donation, we would be incredibly flattered and greatly appreciate it. We'll be sure to give any of our generous donors a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let's begin the tale of The Lady of the Dunes. Our story begins on July 26, 1974 in Barnstable County, Massachusetts. That day, a 13-year-old girl is out walking her dog around the Race Point Dunes, which are located just outside of Provincetown. The girl winds up stumbling across the decomposing nude body of a woman and notifies the police. It's estimated that the victim is between 20 to 40 years old and has been dead approximately 10 days to 3 weeks at this point. She has an athletic build with a height between 5'6" and 5'8", and her weight is around 145 pounds. The decomposition has made the woman's face unrecognizable, but she has long auburn or reddish blonde hair which is tied back in a ponytail, and her toenails are painted pink. Her head was rested atop a pair of folded Wrangler jeans and a blue bandana, which we can only assume was her clothing. It's clear the victim had been murdered, as she had been killed with a blow to the head, which crushed the left side of her skull. Her throat was slashed so deeply that it nearly reached her spine and came close to completely severing her head from her body. But it gets even more gruesome. Both of the woman's hands had been completely removed, one at the wrist and the other at the elbow. There were also signs that she had been sexually assaulted post-mortem, possibly with a piece of wood. The way the victim was positioned on the towel suggested that she had a companion resting beside her before she was killed. There were no signs of struggle, as it appeared that the towel and the surrounding area hadn't been disturbed. The killer may have very well snuck up behind the victim and delivered the fatal blow to her head while she was sunbathing or sleeping. Two sets of footprints were found leading to the body, and there were tire tracks about 50 yards away next to the nearest road. So the big problem, obviously, was that the victim didn't have any form of identification on her, and it seemed like the killer had taken steps to ensure she couldn't be identified. Of course, the removal of both her hands ensured that no one would be able to identify her using fingerprints. But here's the particularly frustrating part. The woman's teeth should have been a very distinctive clue. She had extensive dental work done, as there were gold crowns in her teeth estimated to be worth between 5 and 10 grand at that time. Apparently, the type of work she had was referred to as the New York style of dentistry, though I'm not entirely sure what that means. But unfortunately, the killer had also gone to the trouble of removing some of her teeth, so it would now be extra difficult to make a match with dental records. Since there wasn't much in the way of evidence found at the murder scene, investigators didn't have a lot to work with, so now they were stuck trying to identify both the victim and her killer, and they didn't have much success. They searched thousands of missing persons cases, but could not find anyone who was a concrete match to the decedent. As a result, she was buried in a cemetery in Provincetown under a headstone which simply read, "Unidentified female body." Her new nickname would be, "The Lady of the Dunes." But of course, this was hardly the end of the investigation. Believe it or not, the Provincetown police chief was so determined to solve this case that he decided not to bury the victim's skull. Instead, he decided to keep the skull on his desk as a constant motivator, which is pretty morbid, and I'm not sure a police chief could get away with doing something like that today. However, in 1979, he used this as an opportunity to turn the skull over to a forensic artist, who used it to create a facial construction of the victim. A year after that, her body was exhumed for re-examination, though it didn't turn up anything to help determine her identity. There were a bunch of false leads over the next couple of decades, as numerous people would come forward to say that the Lady of the Dunes resembled someone they knew. One Boston woman believed the victim might be her sister, who had been missing since 1972. A Canadian woman claimed that a female friend of hers told her she'd seen her father strangle a woman in Provincetown during the 1970s, but I don't think this woman who said this was ever tracked down. At one point, a psychic provided authorities with the name of a missing nurse and claimed she was the Lady of the Dunes, but, surprise, surprise, the aforementioned nurse actually turned out to be alive and well. Most of these tips turned out to be dead ends, but during the 1990s, a very intriguing lead finally surfaced. One of the detectives on the case announced that he believed the Lady of the Dunes might be a woman named Rory Jean Kessinger. In 1973, the 25-year-old Kessinger was arrested in Pembroke, Massachusetts as part of a drug raid. She actually attempted to shoot a policeman during the raid and was charged with assault with intent to kill. Kessinger had a pretty rough life and was a tough character, to say the least. She was a runaway from the age of 15 who soon became involved in drugs and bank robbery and lived under at least 5 different aliases. She eventually became part of a full-fledged gun-running drug smuggling syndicate, and by 1973, federal agents were pursuing these people all throughout the country. When Kessinger and her associates arrived in Massachusetts, they were finally busted. Kessinger was held in the Plymouth County Correctional Facility to await trial. But on May 27th, a corrupt guard managed to smuggle her a hacksaw blade, which she used to cut the lock and bars of her cell. She then managed to escape from the facility by using some sheets to climb out a window, and someone was apparently waiting for her outside as her getaway driver. After that, Rory Jean Kessinger was never seen again. If you look at photographs of Kessinger, she does resemble the Lady of the Dunes. It was speculated that one or more of Kessinger's criminal associates decided to murder her before she could be recaptured and potentially provide the authorities with vital information about their activities. That would explain the removal of her hands, because obviously Kessinger's fingerprints would have been on file. Now, as you probably know, DNA testing was not available back in 1974, but had become a vital tool for solving cold cases by the time Kessinger's name entered the investigation. In 2000, the Lady of the Dunes was exhumed once again, and DNA was extracted from her bone marrow. Kessinger's mother was tracked down, and she provided a sample of her own DNA to investigators. But unfortunately, there was no match. So Rory Jean Kessinger was conclusively ruled out as being the Lady of the Dunes. But it wasn't long before another interesting lead came about. Let's now talk about a murderer named Haddon Clark, who has been incarcerated since 1992 for a pair of murders, one of his victims being a 6-year-old girl. It is possible Clark might be a full-fledged serial killer, as he claims to have murdered and buried the bodies of at least 11 more victims in the Cape Cod area. In 2004, Clark sent a letter to a pen pal with a hand-drawn map of the Cape Cod area, which featured his grandfather's home. Clark wrote, "The murder is still unsolved, and what the police are looking for is in my grandfather's garden." He also included a drawing of a nude woman on her stomach with her hands missing, and the words, "Summer 1974. Of course, this looked just like the Lady of the Dunes. Clark took credit for murdering her, but said he would never reveal her identity because the police beat him up once. All that being said, Haddon Clark is a paranoid schizophrenic with a history of lying. He originally confessed about those other 11 murders to a bearded inmate because he thought the guy was Jesus Christ. Clark is also a crossdresser who claims that his female alter ego, named Kristen Bluefin, committed some of his murders. On more than one occasion, he convinced the police to let him out of the prison for a trip to Cape Cod so he could accompany them on a search of his grandfather's property. Oh, and he insisted they allow him to wear women's clothing while they did this. And the bearded Jesus Christ-looking cellmate also had to go along with them because he was the only one who could calm Clark down if he had a psychotic breakdown. The authorities never did find anything on the property, so all these outings were nothing more than a wild goose chase. So after taking all this into account, authorities are very skeptical that Clark actually murdered the Lady of the Dunes. However, one person who might be connected to the crime is perhaps the most infamous mobster of the modern era. Shortly before the murder, a woman resembling the Lady of the Dunes was seen in the company of a figure who is quite notorious in the world of true crime, James Whitey Bulger. Most of you are probably already familiar with Mr. Bulger, but in case you're not, here's a brief rundown. James Bulger, nicknamed Whitey, was an organized crime boss who headed the Winter Hill Gang and pretty much controlled Boston from the late 1970s until the mid-1990s. His list of criminal activities is way too vast to chronicle here, but one of the main reasons Bulger was able to run rampant for so long was because he allegedly served as an informant for the FBI. In exchange for giving up information about his rivals, Bulger's FBI handlers, in particular a corrupt agent named John Connolly, pretty much enabled him to remain free and continue his criminal activities. But by 1994, the whole operation had collapsed, and Bulger was forced to go on the run. He found himself on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list and maintained his spot until June of 2011, when the 81-year-old Bulger was finally captured in Santa Monica. He was eventually sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms and a plethora of charges. Of course, Whitey Bulger is one of the most recognizable criminals of the past several decades. He was recently portrayed by Johnny Depp in the movie Black Mass, and the mobster character whom Jack Nicholson played in Martin Scorsese's Academy Award-winning film The Departed was clearly modeled on Bulger. At the time of this recording, Bulger is 87 years old, and he will remain in prison for the rest of his life. But we will probably never know the full extent of all his crimes. Anyway, Provincetown is approximately 2 hours away from Boston. In 2010, a new reconstruction was made of the Lady of the Dunes' face, and a composite sketch was released to the public. Not long after Whitey Bulger was captured, reports started coming in that he had been seen in Provincetown sometime in 1974 with an unidentified woman who resembled the Lady of the Dunes. As you can imagine, people were much more open about sharing this info now that Bulger was captured. Bulger was known for being a frequent visitor to a Provincetown bar called the Crown and Anchor, and there's been speculation that the green blanket that the victim was laying on came from that establishment. But the most interesting potential tie into Bulger is the way the Lady of the Dunes' teeth were removed. Bulger and his crew were known for removing the teeth of some of their murder victims in order to make it more difficult for them to be identified via dental records. It's also worth noting that some of the unidentified shoe prints found at the murder scene were size 10, and Bulger was a size 10. Since Bulger was into human trafficking, one possible theory is that the victim was a prostitute who originally hailed from another country. If that were the case, and no one from the United States was actually looking for this woman, then it would be much more difficult to link the victim to any missing persons cases, especially during the 1970s. As for Bulger's potential motive for murdering her, well, we'll get back to that in a little bit. In the meantime, this is still not the end of all the intriguing leads to pop up in this case. Believe it or not, both Stephen King and Steven Spielberg have a very loose connection to this story. In the summer of 2015, horror novelist Joe Hill, who happens to be Stephen King's son, read a book featuring the Lady of the Dunes case, and a few weeks later, he attended a 40th anniversary screening of the iconic Steven Spielberg-directed blockbuster, Jaws. When Hill got to a scene in the film featuring a large crowd, he was surprised to see an extra in the background who looked remarkably like the Lady of the Dunes. After the screening, Hill studied the scene several more times and thought the Lady of the Dunes' resemblance to this woman was uncanny. Now, this being the 1970s, there was no shortage of young women with long brown hair, but what really caught Hill's attention was that she was wearing blue jeans and a blue bandana, which, if you'll recall, were the same items of clothing the Lady of the Dunes had beneath her head when she was found. Once again, this is the 1970s, so there wouldn't be any shortage of young, brown-haired women wearing blue jeans and a blue bandana. However, the timeline is very interesting. Jaws was filmed during the summer of 1974 in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, which is located in the Cape Cod area approximately 3 hours away from Provincetown. It's not implausible that this woman could have popped up as an extra in a crowd scene shortly before she was murdered. So Joe Hill went on Tumblr to announce his discovery, even though he was the first to admit that this was probably a major long shot. Indeed, while investigators do think this lead is interesting, they also believe it's probably nothing more than a wild speculation. Even if you were to go back and comb through Jaws' production records, it would probably be extraordinarily difficult to track down the identity of a random extra who appeared with dozens of other people in a brief scene. But hey, Hill did bring the case back into the spotlight again, and it was neat to see one of my favorite films potentially holding the key to an unsolved mysteries. In case you want to go and watch Jaws and see this woman for yourself, the scene occurs at 54 minutes and 2 seconds into the film. This is pretty much the last major development we've had in this case for over a year, so I guess you could say the trail went cold. So who is the Lady of the Dunes? Well, we've heard some interesting theories here. We know for sure that she's not Rory Jean Kessinger, as DNA testing ruled that out. But Kessinger's story is a pretty interesting mystery within a mystery, as she was never caught and has been a missing person ever since she escaped from jail. I do think that she is probably long dead, as she had built up a pretty extensive criminal record ever since she was a teenager, and it's very unlikely that someone like that could just stay off the radar for over 40 years. I think she either died of a drug overdose, or one of her criminal associates killed her to avoid the risk of her being recaptured and providing the police with potentially incriminating information. But getting back to this case, I really don't believe Haddon Clark murdered the Lady of the Dunes, or that he knows her true identity. There is no evidence connecting him to the crime, and he is clearly a mentally unstable person who enjoys toying with the authorities. He probably just heard about the case somehow, and decided to take credit for the murder to amuse himself, and potentially earn himself another trip from prison to Cape Cod. Until I hear otherwise, I'm going to assume this is nothing more than a false lead, and that Clark has no connection to the case. And Joe Hill's sighting of the woman in the crowd scene in Jaws? As much as I'd love for that lead to be true, I think the odds of that woman being her are very, very slim. In spite of the resemblance, there are some key differences. The Lady of the Dunes had reddish auburn hair, but the woman in Jaws appears to have dark brown hair. The whole thing is quite a stretch, but nonetheless, I'm glad that Joe Hill went public with his theory because it got the case some attention again. If the woman in Jaws isn't her, I hope that at some point they do find out who she really was in order to put this theory to rest. So while I don't put much stock in the theories I just described, I am actually very intrigued by the theory that the Lady of the Dunes was a victim of Whitey Bulger. But first, I should mention that even though a 13-year-old girl first reported the Lady of the Dunes to the authorities, she was apparently not the first person to discover the body. Shortly before this, a 9-year-old girl named Sandra Lee was camping with her family outside of Provincetown. Sandra and her sister left the campsite to take her dog for a walk to the Race Point Dunes when they stumbled upon the decomposing body of a nude woman. Being 9 years old at the time, Sandra was absolutely terrified, and neither she nor her sister reported this discovery. In fact, it would be years before she shared this incident with anyone. It's worth noting that this experience had such a profound effect on Sandra Lee that she grew up to become a crime and mystery writer, and even published a fictionalized book based on this very case titled Shantytown, Provincetown's Lady in the Dunes. And Sandra has been one of the biggest advocates of the theory that Whitey Bulger was responsible for her death. During her family's camping trips to Provincetown, Sandra's stepfather would often go get drunk at the Crown and Anchor, the same bar Whitey Bulger was known to frequent. In fact, he actually knew Bulger personally and hung out with him there. But here's an interesting anecdote about the Crown and Anchor. It was a gay bar. In fact, today, there are 7 gay bars and clubs in Provincetown which bear the Crown and Anchor name. You see, there were a lot of rumors that Whitey Bulger was bisexual. It's even been alleged that he worked as a male prostitute in gay bars during his teens. Bulger was apparently very secretive about his trips to Provincetown during the 1970s, and never really told people what he was doing there most of the time. And you can certainly understand why a Boston mobster would journey out of town if he wanted to pursue his homosexual interests, as Provincetown had a reputation for being a safe haven for gays and lesbians during the 1960s and 70s. Okay, so there isn't any hard evidence that Bulger is connected to the Lady of the Dunes, other than he was allegedly seen with a woman resembling her. And there's the fact that her teeth were removed in a manner similar to Bulger's other murder victims. But if he killed her, then I think he would have a very logical motive for doing so. Now, I should clarify that all these stories about Bulger being bisexual, they're all just rumors and innuendo, and I can't be certain any of them are true. But in 1974, Bulger was attempting to muscle his way into becoming the biggest crime kingpin in Boston. As you can probably imagine, organized crime is not a field where they would look favorably upon homosexual activity. If Bulger did like to frequent gay bars, then it makes sense that he would travel several hours out of his hometown to Provincetown. Like I said earlier, Bulger was supposedly very secretive about these trips to Cape Cod, and it was no big secret at the time that the Crown and Anchor was a gay bar. Let's say that the woman seen with Bulger in July of 1974 was the Lady of the Dunes. I don't know when her and Bulger would have met originally, but if she knew some secrets about Bulger's alleged homosexual activities, then I could see how he'd want to ensure this info never reached Boston. So he goes sunbathing with this woman at the Race Point Dunes and decides to murder her, going to the trouble of removing her teeth and hands so that identification will be a lot more difficult and she will never be tied to him. When you're in a position like Whitey Bulger is, reputation is everything, and that still holds true for him today. In the documentary, Whitey, United States vs. James G. Bulger, they show a phone conversation Bulger has with his lawyer after he's been captured. He knows that he'll be found guilty at trial and spend the rest of his life in prison, but the most important thing for him was using the trial as an opportunity to denounce the rumors that he was an FBI informant, because he did not want to be remembered as a rat. And obviously, if rumors ever came out that Bulger was bisexual and liked to frequent gay bars, he would do everything in his power to denounce that too. You'd think by this point, Bulger would have nothing left to lose, but the guy is a sociopath, and he's still going to want to protect his reputation. If Bulger is responsible for the murder of the Lady of the Dunes, or knows the woman's true identity, I don't think he'll ever confess to it. Because if my theory is correct, and this woman knew some potentially incriminating secrets about Bulger, I'm sure he'd prefer they stay buried. But of course, this is all just speculation on my part. For all we know, the Lady of the Dunes could have been murdered by someone we don't even know about, and the victim might have her own fascinating backstory that may never see the light of day. But for the moment, my best theory is that James Whitey Bulger was the killer. But even though this case is 42 years old now, I will not give up hope that it might be solved someday. Like I talked about on my podcast about the El Dorado Jane Doe case, there has been a recent craze of amateur sleuths coming across these profiles of unidentified John Does and Jane Does on the internet, and they either recognize them or match them up with a missing person. And when they send in their tip to the authorities, DNA testing confirms that their hunch was right, and the unidentified decedent gets their name back again. And that could very well happen to the Lady of the Dunes. As I described earlier, Joe Hill made his own attempt to provide authorities with a lead, and while his theory is probably a major long shot, it never hurts to try. So as I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to remind everyone that our website is providing a link to the Lady of the Dunes' profile page at the Doe Network, which contains sketches of the various reconstructions of her face, all her vital statistics, and contact info for the proper authorities should you happen to have any important information. If you think you have any idea about who the Lady of the Dunes is, or who her killer might be, please call in a tip. But if you just have your own theory about who she might be, I'd love to hear from you. Feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. I want to thank all my loyal listeners and supporters out there, especially those from the aforementioned Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide the obligatory shout-out to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and is the managing editor of The Back Row, the website which hosts this very podcast. And of course, a big shout-out to Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. And like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website, so if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. You can also check out my true crime and mystery articles at crack.com and listverse.com, and there's plenty of other non-true crime content you can find right here at The Back Row. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new minisode of The Trail Went Cold.